call the Property Tax Division to order. And we're going to start with Senator Kelash, Senate File Number 27. And Senator Kelash, I believe this is your first stop, and do you have an amendment you would like offered?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an A1 delete all amendment.
Yes, I do. Senator Dibble would move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. We are now on the A1 amendment. Senator Kelash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what I'm offering is a technical language to fix some of last year's bill on the apprenticeship training facilities as far as property taxes go. A couple of things were on line 1-8. We're changing nonprofit corporation to organization and nonprofit trust. That more reflects what the way apprenticeship schools are operated under trust kind of structure. And the other is that in last year's bill, the exemption for the land under the building was added in the conference committee, and we'd like to change that. And then qualify what's acceptable so that only that land and parking spaces that are related to the school, the apprenticeship school, are given a tax break for the property taxes. Any other facilities within that building would be taxed at the regular property tax rate. I have Kyle Macarius from the Carpenters Union to just talk about how it affects their apprenticeship schools around the state.
Mr. Macarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. My name is Kyle Macarios from the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Our union participates along with the employers in joint apprenticeship trust training. We spend approximately $3.5 million a year on apprenticeship and skill enhancement training for journeypersons. This money is entirely 100% funded in the private sector. We don't come here every year asking the legislature for funding to help run these state-of-the-art training centers. What we're asking here is that we be treated similarly to other training centers and other schools in the state, that our facilities that are used exclusively for training and educational purposes be exempt from property taxes so long as they are operated in a nonprofit manner, and that exemption include the parking at the schools. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Senator Kelash, we've seen this issue a couple years now. Let's hope that this is going to be the solution. Questions, members? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, just curious, Senator Kelash or Mr. McCarry, excuse me, Kyle. How do we determine the proportionality of the square footage of the parking? Is that determined by local zoning regs or just
Mr. McCarro?
Just curious. I'm sure. Support the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble. We have several of our facilities around the state are different. Some of them are just 100% schools, but for instance, our office here on Olive Street is a campus, so to speak, where there's two training schools with different addresses in the same building, as well as a credit union in our union offices. The school portions of the building are literally separate entities. I, for instance, don't have a key to get into those facilities. So what we're proposing is that the amount of square feet in the building that is taken up by the schools be exempted, and that the same proportion of the parking spaces.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. That relates to it.
That helps. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, is the Ramsey County Assessor here by chance? John Hogan here from the department?
Hagan.
Or Hagan, I'm sorry.
John Hagan. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hagan.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hagan, when we talked about this, there was an issue with the Ramsey County Assessor. I thought the legislation we passed earlier would have exempted one of the training facilities in St. Paul from the property tax, but apparently the assessor said we didn't quite have the language right with the word nonprofit. When you and I talked about it, you indicated to me you were going to talk with the Ramsey County assessor. I'm wondering if the Ramsey County assessor thinks this new language will provide for the exemption of that apprentice training space on Olive Street.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we have not had that conversation with the Ramsey County assessor yet, and I apologize. We had a meeting scheduled for Thursday, which was canceled at the last minute because there wasn't enough commitment from some of the participants. We do believe that we have a sense that the current language would exempt the property, even though it is held in a trust. We have to make have that discussion with the Ramsey County assessor, and hopefully we can reach an accord on that.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hagan, maybe you can let me know how that goes, and if it doesn't work, the Ramsey County assessor or doesn't want to commit, maybe we'll just mention a building on Olive Street. We need to get that specific.
And Mr. Hagan, when you're having the discussion about this, I wonder if we don't need to pay a little attention to putting some parameters around the area that this parking area could be as total area. And the original bill is drafted had a half acre. I don't know if that's the right amount or not, but let's have a little discussion about that as we move forward here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I'll certainly do that.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Yeah, the A1 amendment's on. So Senator Bach moves Senate File 27 be laid over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion fails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess we probably don't need to vote on all this. We don't need to vote on all this. Senator Saxhawk, we're going to move around a little bit, members. Senator Saxhawk has another a conflict, so he was wondering if he could be moved up on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we'll be rather brief, or I hope we will be.
We'll see.
Number 12.
Number
767.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1767 is a bill that will make changes in leased seasonal recreational land. With me today is Jeff Forrester, Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Rec Property Owners, and he's going to give some brief testimony and help answer any questions.
Mr. Forrester, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forrester, and I am Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And I would like to thank Senator Saxhawk, Bach, and Scoy for carrying this bill. As you know, we tried to get it done last year and ended up with just St. Louis County being the only county that excluded these properties. This would create equal application across the state. A portion of the federal use permits that these people pay on this land is returned to the state as PILT payments. But they have very tight restrictions on these properties, how they can paint them. They can't cut any wood. If you and I wanted to go camping in their front yard, for instance, we could do that because they don't own the land, yet they're still paying tax on it. So we support this bill, and I'll stand for questions if there are any.
Questions, members? And this is an issue that we dealt with last year in conference committee, I believe, dealing with hunting, a lot of hunting lands. And Mr. Hagan, did you want to comment on this at all?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hagan.
John Hagan from the Department of Revenue. I guess this bill concerns us, to be quite honest with you. It would create a tax shift onto other property owners. We were not ever completely in favor of exempting this portion of the property where, in our estimation, the leased property should have been assessed, at least pursuant to the statute. When it's federally or county or city-owned property that's leased to a private individual should be assessed. Last year, the legislature did put in a provision that at a local option, if the counties were not assessing these properties, they would have the opportunity to, by local option, exempt all these properties. we'd be, I guess, reluctant to advocate exempting all these leases throughout the state, which would in effect any city, county, or federally owned lands would be exempted from property tax, which would result in a shift on to other property owners and use of the property without any tax liability.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I had forgotten what kind of properties these are. Mr. Hagan, can you give us some examples?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, my understanding is these are leased recreational properties that are leased on lakes. It could be any type of land that's owned by a government leased to a private individual, and that private individual would have exclusive use of that property just as they owned it, although they wouldn't have fee ownership. But by law, they're required, with the exception of the local option, they are required to be treated for purposes of taxation as if they were the owner.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Hagan, how long usually are the lease terms and the durations?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, I'm not certain what the lease terms are. I could certainly find out. I don't know that.
Senators, Mr. Forrester.
Yes. Well, specifically, these are lands that were leased from the National Forest Service beginning back in the 1800s when the Forest Service was first created. I think the first one was 1905 in this state. Many of these places have been in families for, 80 years. They do not have exclusive use of the land. It's national forest land. They do not own it. They cannot cut the trees. Other people can use it. They have a lease on it, a conditional use permit, and they pay fees for that. In some cases, these fees are, $6,000-$8,000 a year because the Forest Service is readjusting these fees. A portion of those fees are returned to the state of Minnesota as payments in lieu of taxes, and then the state taxes this property again, even though they don't have control of it. Like I said before, if you and I if I had a federal use permit on national forest land and you wanted to come and camp in my front yard, you could do it. So they're being taxed on land that they don't own, they can't control, on property that's very tightly constricted. They can only have it can only be certain colors. The roof can only be a certain type. They can only be a certain size.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Saxon.
Most of these properties that we're concerned about right now are in the Chippewa National Forest. And so for that reason, there is a lot of federal land and a lot of federal land around some large lakes, and that's where the majority of these leases are.
Well, Senator Saxon, but you are making this statewide at this point, so it would affect a lot of other parcels. We'll have to take that into consideration. Any other questions, members? Cheryl Lay, Senate
Mr.
File.
Chair.
Senator Bach.
I'm just wondering if my old friend Glenn Dorfman is in the audience. If I could, I know he is. He has an issue with this, and I thought if he was here, maybe I could have the opportunity to have him at the tax committee table again. But if he's not here, he's missed an opportunity. But I hope he doesn't come see me tomorrow about this.
Mr. Chair, the realtors are here.
Not here. Anybody else that would like to speak for or against 1767? Come forward, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Andres, realtor with Edina Realty. I own a property in the Chippewa National Forest and just want to speak in favor of this bill. A couple of things that came up in terms of how these operate and so on. It is a 20-year renewable lease with no guarantee. So we went through a big, we just reissued those leases this year at a cost that's going to be about four or five times higher than the previous lease. It is indexed. I think one of the important pieces of this is that the State Forest can cancel our lease with notice, 10-day or 10-year notice, and have us remove any cabin we might have. The cabins that are on these properties are small. The maximum size is a 900-square-foot footprint. That's the maximum. The majority are between 500 and 750 square feet. This is a small cabin. It's a three-car garage size property. I think it's important to note that when they're talking about the PLIT payments, that 25% by law of our lease fee goes directly to the county. And this was set up to be in lieu of taxes because the federal forest was taking tax revenue out of the county when they enacted the forest. So this is where the money goes, in lieu of taxes, because the county is not getting taxed on that piece. So our lease fee is paying those taxes on that piece of property, and now we're being and have been paying taxes twice on that lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Chair will lay Senate File 1767 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Olson. Senate File 130.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today on behalf of Senate File 130, and in a nutshell, what this bill would do is return seasonal recreational property taxes to school districts in terms of paying for operating expenses. Right now, they're exempt from levy referendums. That would be for operating expenses, and instead are paying what used to be a percentage of CI property taxes to the general fund for the state. And Mr. Chair, I know you're more familiar than I am with how this all works and with the history that led to this, but I'll briefly, for the public and for anyone who might not be as familiar, do the best I can to explain what I believe happened. I understand that under Governor Jesse Ventura, a law was passed that took the money that used to go from the property tax value of the entire school district to the school district to help support operating expenses and exempted the seasonal rec property from making a contribution, and instead it went to the general fund. So this bill would not increase property taxes for seasonal rec properties. In fact, according to, I think, the runs that have been done on this, for the most part, those taxes would decrease. But what would happen is that the areas that have a high percentage of seasonal rec property would have a much easier time passing operating referendums because the residents who are now having to pay the 100% of the cost of those operating referendums would spread that cost out among all the tax value in the school district. And to talk specifically about the impact that it has on school districts, I have with me here today the Mr. Rick Scogan, who's the business manager for the Pequot Lake School District, and also Mr. Rick Monell, the superintendent of schools there. And if we could have passed out, they have put together some materials here that I think are extremely illustrative of what's happening with this exemption in terms of school districts' ability to pass these operating referendums. And specifically, there's a colored map here. So I wonder if we could get this, these handed out. I also have, Mr. Chair, letters from the superintendents in Crosby, Ironton, Brainerd, Park Rapids, and Bemidji, all in support of this bill. And I know that there are many other school superintendents as well. In fact, I think they've been uniform in our area in support of this. I'll just read briefly from a letter in from the Bemidji School Superintendent Jim Hess, page 2 of that letter, which to me kind of summarizes the situation. After exempting seasonal recreational property and factoring in other forms of property tax relief, Residential property owners are nearly the only ones left and must make a maximum effort to support schools. With a lack of manufacturing or industrial tax base, sparse population, and significant exemptions, primarily this exemption, a homeowner in Bemidji pays a much heavier toll to support a 501 per pupil operating level on property than a homeowner in other communities, you know, that don't have the seasonal recreational issue to any great extent. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Mr. Scope or Mr. Linnell.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Senator Olson. And I didn't catch your name.
Rick Linnell.
Linnell?
Thank you. Linnell. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for allowing testimony today on Senate File 130. This is a critical bill. When passed into law, will allow a relatively small number of school districts with high seasonal recreational values to access levy referendums fairly with other districts. Only 42 districts do not have any referendum or a $1 referendum. The vast majority of these districts are located in the Lakes Country with correspondingly high seasonal recreational values. Many other districts within the Lake Country have referendums that are substantially lower than the average statewide. Specifically in Pequot Lakes, it is unlikely our local taxpayers will pass a referendum with the current system, knowing that over 50% property values located within our district are free from that specific levy. This resistance puts our students at an educational disadvantage. Approximately 88% of the districts in the state of Minnesota have passed excess levy referendums. We are asking that you level the playing field for Pequot Lakes and other high seasonal recreational value districts so that our students have the potential to access the referendum dollars enjoyed by over 95% of the students in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Linnell. Mr. Scogan, pleasure to meet you. I think we've talked
pleasure to meet you, Senator Scogan.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator Scogan, my name is Rick Scogan. I am the business manager at Pequot Lakes. Senator Scoy, members of the committee, thank you for the honor of coming to speak to you today about Senate File 130. I have a packet that I put together. I'd like you to look at quickly if you have the packet in front of you. This packet explains our position in Pequot, and I think it also lays out with some specificity the problem in the northern part of the state of Minnesota with excess levy referendums. I'm not going to today get into the merits of the funding system of the education of Minnesota because that's another discussion for another day. But today we're talking about the referendums themselves, and 88% of the districts in the state currently have excess levy referendums. 42 districts, 12% do not. The packet that I passed out has the letter that Mr. Linnell, the superintendent, just read for you. And on page 2 of that referendum, or page 2 of the packet, there's a quick chart that explains the difference between the current property system and the property system that would be in effect in Pequot with the passage of Senate File 130. And very quickly, on the bottom parts of that particular sheet, you'll see that a referendum market value of $100,000, $250,000, or $500,000 under the current rules have X amount of dollars of tax. And we could play with the numbers of the referendum, but we're just talking about a number. On a $500,000 house, there's a $333 tax at a certain level of referendum. Currently, with the passage of Senate File 130, that tax impact is cut approximately in half. So in Pequot Lakes, almost half of the value of the district, or a little over half of the value of the district, is in seasonal recreational properties that we're unable to access for the education of our kids. That said, the next page of the handout lists those districts in the state of Minnesota that currently are without an operating referendum, and I assert at an educational disadvantage relative to the other 88% of the districts in the state. Those districts are, for the most part, relatively small. There are districts, like Senator Olson spoke about with Bemidji, Brainerd, Grand Rapids, I believe, that have operating referendums that are below the state average because they're unable to pass anything higher than that. I think the most telling piece of information that is in my packet, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is on the last page, which is a graphic of the districts in the state of Minnesota that do not have referendums. And I've colored in those districts and their geographic boundaries. And, Mr. Chair, you'll note, and senators of the committee, you'll note that about almost all of them are in the northern half of the state. There are three or four southern Minnesota districts that don't have referendums. But geographically speaking, almost all of them are in the northern half of the state. They're in the lake country. They have high seasonal recreational values. They're unable to pass referendums. They're unable to provide educational equality for their children. And I would appreciate it if you would consider and pass along Senate File 130 to the full Senate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Scogan. And Senator Olson, appreciate you bringing this issue forward again this year. As you know, the Senate has been trying to accomplish this for a number of years now, and we'll see what we can do again this year. There is a little difference in the proposal this year that I think that the Tax Committee is going to want to take a look at. In the previous years, we've paid for this with general fund money, and this year we've got a shift going on that we're going to want to probably address somehow, but we'll see how we can do that later on. Questions, members? Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask maybe Ms. Off or Senator Olson to talk about Section 3 of the bill. I'm just trying to understand. Is that the shift that you were referring to?
Yes, Senator Moore, that is the shift that's going on when we take the 5% of the state general tax that currently is paid by the seasonal rec out of the state business tax and put it into the school district. It reshifts that 5% onto the other properties that are paying that seasonal or that state business tax.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Zoft, could you achieve the first part of the bill without that part of the bill, or is that what's paying for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, they're actually two distinct functions, but they do come together in the sense that Section 1 of the bill would impose the local tax, the school district tax, on these seasonal recreational properties, and the trade-off for that is that they would no longer be required to pay the state general tax. And the shift is from the burden that had been on the seasonal rec properties onto the CI properties within the state general tax.
Well, Ms. Chair and Ms. Zoff, I know that that's one way to try to address that, but does it work to just say you will pay both taxes or no? May I just?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, yes. I mean, that is an option. I think this was created as kind of a trade-off between the two tax burdens at the time. But they do operate independently of each other.
Well, and that's just what I wanted to ask. I don't want people to get mad at me. I just wanted to make it clear that are they so intertwined that you have to do both, or is there a choice to do one or the other and to just make it more clean?
Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, the way I remember this in 2001, no disrespect to Governor Ventura, but he didn't want to pay excess operating levy taxes on his cabin.
I know.
So what ended up happening to the cabin owners is they got lumped in with the commercial industrial property and ended up subject to the state general tax. It's not income producing property like CI property is. And how they ever got stuck in there, we'd have to ask Senator Pogemiller and Representative Abrams at the time, I guess. But the state general tax, I mean, you can argue that property taxes on CI property is income producing, and that imposing the state general tax on them to help them pay for some funding in the general fund is, I mean, the business community benefits from things like education funding and higher ed and things, but somehow cabins got put in there and were asked to be treated like commercial industrial property, and they clearly are different. I mean, they're not income-producing, and it's put a significant burden on cabin taxes. I'm very sensitive to that because I've got a lot of cabins in my district, and every year there are fewer and fewer just people to pack a lunch bucket and go to work people able to own cabins. And this state general tax is creating a serious problem making property taxes affordable for cabin owners, just regular families that have had a cabin for generations in the family. And the second problem is the problem for school districts that, you know, and I know Ms. Wanick, I don't know if she's here today, from Pelican Rapids School District came to see me. And, I mean, they've got the classic example. They have $1.3 billion of tax capacity in their district. $800 million of it is cabins. I mean, the majority of their taxes in their district are cabins. So, consequently, they have zero excess operating levy because they can't get one passed. So what is going to happen around the state? And I had this discussion with the governor at the end, right at the very end of the negotiations last year. Governor, what happens? And I used the Cook County School District, Grand Marais, and my district is the example. In Cook County, and you'll see they're green on the map, they don't have an excess operating levy. Cook County School District, the government owns 91% of the land. Of what's left, 65% is cabins. There is nothing to tax. There's nobody to consolidate with. They butt up against Canada and Lake Superior. So I asked the governor, I said, Governor, what is the future for the kids in Grand Marais? If we've built a system that is so unfair to them that they're going to have no curriculum left. And so, Senator Olson, I want to thank you for carrying this because there are school kids in districts, I think probably about, sorry if I missed the testimony, about 30 districts in the state where school funding is falling way behind under the Plenty Administration school funding formula, where if you can pass an excess operating levy, your school district can have money, but if you can't, well, then too bad for you. You kids, you know, in Grand Marais or in Pelican Rapids or in Brainerd, you get left behind. And it just doesn't seem like the right policy. So not that this will put more money into those schools, but it's certainly going to make it a little easier, a little fairer for the school district to be able to gain some additional money on the formula like the other 300 and some school districts in this state have. And then the other little piece of it is just maybe we can help with the property tax burden on cabins so that we can keep some cabins that have been in the family for generations in the family. I mean, so I think there's two good reasons to do this, and I hope that the tax conference committee is willing to dig in with the governor this year and we can fix, I think, what was clearly an inequity that was done in 2001 when we did the school takeover, 2001 tax bill.
Thank you. Mr. Forrester, would you want to say something from the seasonal rec? The Seasonal Property Owners Coalition, your name's on the list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. Much of what I had to say, Senator Bach, just said. Maybe what I might be able to add is, you know, when the state general tax first came in and there was this shift off of the excess operating levies and onto the state general tax, our understanding at the time was that a portion of that tax was going to be returned to local school districts in lieu of taxes, and it was not. My wife is a teacher, and she taught in the Tower Sedan schools, and so she's very familiar with education up there. She's a teacher now in Minneapolis. I have cousins that go to that school, and most cabin owners, I think, have strong family ties to their areas where their cabins are located and are very sensitive to school funding. One of our concerns is that, you know, excess operating levies used to be just that, excess operating levies. And now it seems like they're becoming a major funding source. And so we're a little bit concerned that this doesn't actually solve the sort of deeper systemic problem. And again, we're asking people to voluntarily raise their taxes, which I think is a little bit of a problem. But you know, we stand ready to work with Senator Olson and the committee in any way that we can to find an equitable solution to this. Taking in mind pretty much everything Senator Bach had to say. I think he read my notes before he spoke. So,
well, Mr. Forrester, Mr. Forrester, the question that I have for you is your organization supports the idea of removing the seasonal rec from the state general tax and placing them into the voter-approved referendum for schools?
Boy, we sure understand the need to do that. And if I seem a little bit hesitant, I think that there's I'm remembering back to the late 90s when we were on the excess operating levies, and there would be articles in the small newspapers saying, well, you know, 60% of this tax is going to be paid by cabin owners. So, you know, we're idiots not to vote for it. And when there's a disconnect between people spending the money and people paying the money, and then there's no accountability, I think that's a little bit of a problem. You know, I pay every year on a capital. I mean, you know, cabin. There's a myth that I've seen in the papers that cabin owners don't pay school taxes now as a result of this removal, and we do. It's just that small excess operating levy that we're excused from. But I pay for a pool up north. It's on my levy. And a few summers ago, my daughter wanted to take swimming lessons. So we go over to the pool that's offering free lessons, and they won't let her in the pool because she's non-resident. So, you know, there is an issue there. But yes, we definitely support the schools, and we're not opposed to this measure. I'm just, you know, past experience has made me a titch skittish.
You'd like us to fix the school funding at the same time?
That would be my preference. Yes.
Okay, so Senator Dibble.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize the point that Mr. Forrester made about these excess operating levies are kind of unwinding the 2001 takeover. As we've unwound the 2001 takeover, we've gone to these operating levies to basically put into what should be being put into the per pupil formula. So we're not solving that problem by doing this. We're kind of recognizing that there is an ongoing existing problem. So until we actually grapple with that, we'll continue to have these kind of conversations.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I just was going to go back also to Senator Moy's question earlier and say, I think the reason the bill was designed this way was in order to make it revenue neutral in these difficult financial times. And the reason this direction was chosen is because that was just be kind of putting things back to the way they were before. But to the extent that Senator Skoy has told me he wants to work, you know, with the committee and find a way to fund this so that we can have at least some equity between around the state to deal with this really big disparity in education funding, I would be grateful and pleased, you know, if there could be a way to fund this other than what's proposed in the bill.
Ms. Larson, are you looking to say something on this issue? Anybody else would like to speak in support of or in opposition to 130?
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I'd just like to address Senator Bach. Thank you.
Mr. Lano.
I appreciate what you had to say about Cook County. I'm a graduate of Cook County Grand Marais. And knowing that they have a superintendency opening up there, I'm not interested in going, quite frankly. Because
I understand why.
And I still do have family up there. Just so the committee knows that as superintendent of schools, it is not our intent to go out and ask for operating levies just to have the money in case we need it. That is not what this is about. It's about finding the needs for our students and getting the curricular things for our students that school districts need that are going to make our achievements grow and have higher expectations. We don't intend to at this particular time, even if the bill would pass at this time, to go out and ask for an operating levy in Pequot Lakes, simply because we are concerned about the economic status of our state at this particular time and our community members. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Chair Lay, Senate file, and thank you, Senator Olson, for bringing this forward. We'll try to work on this again this year. Chair Lay, Senate file number 130 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Senator Murphy. Welcome to the committee, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You want Senate File 463 first?
Personal, that'd be fine.
The pollution control equipment?
Right, that'd be fine, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 463 is simply a bill which attempts to put back in some sanity into some of the practices by the Department of Revenue when it comes to taxing utilities, especially the personal property that is involved with those utilities, known as pollution control equipment. There's two power stations, actually there's three power stations in the state of Minnesota, the three nuclear plants that we have, the two at Prairie Island and the one in Monticello, that has a lot of this personal property tax. A lot of the personal property tax on equipment that should be being paid is not being paid because of the, in my opinion, ambiguity of the law and the way that the law has been, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the way that the law has been interpreted. Mr. Chairman and members, there, as I said, as a former employee at a nuclear power plant, I can tell you that several of the pieces of equipment, large pieces of equipment, very valuable pieces of equipment that are exempted from personal property tax under this pollution control exemption, they have nothing to do with pollution control. It safeguards equipment. It's there in case, you know, worst case scenario happens. The pollution control exemption, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of most legislators, was put on the books for good purposes. And it's for equipment that monitors and cleans the environment on a continual basis. That's what we in the legislature believe that exemption is to be used for, not for equipment that sits there and doesn't run unless two things, or three things actually happen. One, an operator comes by with a checklist on a monthly startup, because this equipment never runs unless somebody comes by and manually starts it up to prove operability. The other reason, there's two other reasons why it could start automatically. One is on some sort of, you know, electrical, or it would get a start signal that was false and it would cause it to start. Or it got a start signal because something bad happened. Now, equipment like that should be taxed. That's not pollution control equipment. Pollution control equipment is the type of equipment that used to be down here at the High Bridge plant. And when particulate matter is going out the stack, the federal government stepped in many, many years ago and said, okay, you got to clean this up. Well, at that time, when that plant was built down there, they had what was called electrostatic precipitators, ESPs. That's pollution control equipment. What that did was the air goes through that process, and through a process of electrifying plates, it withdrew the vast majority of particulate that was going out the stack. That's pollution control equipment. But at Prairie Island and Monticello, they get the exemption on things like safety injection pumps. Once again, those pumps never run. They're not pollution control equipment. They're safeguards equipment. They've got equipment that's called the Safeguards Bus. The Safeguards Bus is not used. It's a bank of electrical equipment that, it's a big electrical panel, and what that panel does is it starts that Safeguards equipment. That is exempted from tax. Mr. Chairman and members, I can't tell you how many pieces of equipment. This law, there is problems with this law, and it needs to be rectified. And the two mayors from the two utility communities are here with me today, and they've got several handouts that I believe were in your packet, but they've got a couple of charts that are very telling as to what has happened in regards with this personal property tax exemption on pollution control equipment, and then what, the local jurisdictions, what type of decrease they've seen in the amount of property taxes that utilities have paid over the past 10 years. And members, Senator Bach, if you think the changes that were made to seasonal rec have hurt your communities, you should see how this utility taxation is hurting host communities. It's really starting to get out of hand. And our property owners of residential property, at least in Redland, my neighbors are none too happy about it. And I think that that's why you've seen letters of intent to intercede on behalf of the city in the expansion of the relicensing of the Prairie Island plant by the city of Red Wing. It's because because of this drastic devaluation of the, I shouldn't say devaluation, drop in property taxes paid. Senator Dibble has one of the charts there in his left hand, and it's just, Mr. Chairman, the city of Red Wing, Becker, Monticello, a lot of the host communities, we can't go on like this.
Well, thank you, Senator Murphy, and we've got Mayor Howell from Red Wing. Mayor Howell, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Howell. I'm the mayor of the city of Red Wing. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate File 463 on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. As a mayor of the citizen of Red Wing, I appreciate the importance of controlling pollution control from electrical generating facilities, but we really see this as a question of fairness. Generating electricity and controlling pollution caused by this generation benefits not only the citizens of Red Wing, but citizens throughout the state of Minnesota. We believe that if the state values controlling pollution, the cost should be paid by everyone benefiting from the equipment, not just the citizens from the host communities. The pollution control exemption was enacted in 1967, before the federal and state governments regulated air and water pollution. 40 years later, the regulatory landscape has changed significantly. Controlling emissions and other pollutants is now required by law and as a cost of doing business. In other words, this law is really not an incentive. Utilities are often receiving tax breaks simply for complying with the law. The legislation recognizes that the cost of pollution control should be spread to everyone who benefits from that electricity by giving utilities the power to apply to the ratepayers, to apply rate riders, excuse me. These rate riders allow utility companies to pass along the cost of certain pollution control equipment to electricity consumers. This type of solution is more fair than a tax exemption and increases the tax burdens on residents and businesses of host communities. This exemption has had a significant financial impact on the homeowners and businesses in our cities, counties, and school districts. In Red Wing, approximately $262 million is excluded from the total market value as a result of the exemption. After depreciation, it still represents $142 million. This means that the property tax burden for all properties in Red Wing, including business and homeowners, is 11% higher than it would be without the exemption. This is a significant burden on our school district, our residents of Red Wing, and our residents of Goodhue County. In closing, the city of Red Wing wants a good relationship with our Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant. On Monday, our city passed Resolution 5973, supporting the resolution, the legislation to eliminate the pollution control exemption. And let me might add that I believe this is a fair and reasonable bill that Senator Murphy has put forth. It is only exempting pollution control going forward. It does not remove any current exemptions that they currently are benefiting from. There's other jurisdictions, other states that have actually eliminated all pollution control exemptions. So we simply believe the fairest approach to controlling pollution is to spread the cost out to all ratepayers, not simply to have the host community bear the burden. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mayor Przinski.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Tax Committee. Actually, the city administrator in Becker.
Oh, city administrator.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on Senate File 463, which would eliminate the pollution control exemption. We believe the pollution control exemption unfairly places costs on our citizens.
Could you pull the mic in just a little bit? I'm having.
Yeah. Is that better? The residents of Becker and other host cities contend with burdens that other communities do not face. For example, a coal-fired plant like Sherco, located in Becker, accumulation of coal dust due to the stockpiling of coal, increased rail traffic due to the burning of 3 unit trains of coal per day, additional noise, additional public safety and public works services. We believe that when the coal plant was sited in our community, the trade-off for hosting the plant was the fact that we would be compensated through the property taxes the facility would pay. The pollution control exemption significantly erodes the tax base for the city. For example, in Becker, the Sherco plant is currently valued at $569 million. The market value would be an additional $197 million without the pollution control exemption. What does that mean to our residents? It means an additional 20% higher taxes because of the pollution control exemption. We are particularly concerned about the future impact of this exemption as additional equipment is added and the value of old equipment is depreciated. For example, at the Oak Park Heights King facility, approximately $425 million in capital equipment was added during the MRP project. Of that, $206 million of that equipment is considered exempt. In Becker, we have a large project that is just kicking off at our plant. The value of that project is estimated to be about $1 billion. That's a billion with a B, over the next several years. Our understanding is that a significant portion of that value is considered pollution control equipment, which would receive this exemption and would be kept out of the city's net tax capacity. In closing, we believe pollution control equipment is important to everyone in the state of Minnesota. Spreading the cost of this equipment to everyone who benefits is a fair solution, rather than increasing the tax burden on homeowners and businesses in host communities through the pollution control exemption. We urge your support for Senate File 463.
Thank you, Mr. Przinski. Senator Murphy, the way I'm reading this on line 17 and line 18, so no part of the electrical generation plant would be exempt if this was to become law? Or in your discussion, you talked about the part that pollution control that was running continuously.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members, if you look further up the bill to what current law is, it says personal property is used primarily for the abatement and control of air, water, or land pollution is exempt to the extent that it is used, and the real property is exempt if it is used primarily for abatement of, and then it talks about the environmental aspects. But it says primarily for abatement of. And that's what's wrong with this law. It's being misinterpreted. If you go down to where our new language starts, here's what I believe, and Ms. Zoff can correct me if I'm wrong, but what we're trying to do here is We're just saying that it's exempt under this section only if, and then it meets 1, 2, and then down to B.
So, Senator Murphy, your intent is to still give the exemption for the equipment that is used ongoing, that's running every day, but the stuff that's sitting off to the side that's kind of not being used is not to be exempt.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. That is that's always been our contention, that the property that is the piece of equipment that's not being used to for primarily for pollution control, I mean, it should be taxed like all the other equipment at these facilities.
Well, Senator Murphy, I think the way this reads now is anything new would be taxed.
Well, that's fine too, Mr. Chairman.
We might want to work on that just a little bit.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, it's clearly not it's clearly not my intention to tax pieces of real pollution control equipment like scrubbers and bag houses in the case of the Becker plant, but pieces of equipment that are being exempt at the Becker plant that are not pollution control equipment,
should be taxed.
It should be taxed. And I mean, there's a way that utilities, and you know, this is kind of a stretch, and they may say that they're not doing this, but you know, if I was in charge of the company that I used to work for, I would claim everything. Because, you know, any barroom lawyer can make an argument on just about anything. It could be the parking lot. Well, it collects water, and we don't want the water to run off, so we run and collect the water in the parking lot, and it runs into a collection system. So we're going to claim the parking lot. I mean, it could be anything, Mr. Chairman. And maybe my frustration is not so much with the utilities, but it's the way that the law is being handled by the department. They should have one person over there who actually knows what the inside of a powerhouse looks like and is able to separate fact from fiction.
Senator Murphy, we've got a Mr. Reinberger from Excel that wanted to testify. Let's get the testimony. Mr. Reinberger?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
Well, I doubt that he's coming to support the bill.
I don't think he is either, but we're going to listen to what Mr. Reinberger has to say.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Actually, my name's Jim Duvall. Mr. Reinberger and I are actually switching horses. We're both from Excel. He's going to cover the subsequent bill. I'm going to cover this
okay.
bill.
Mr. Duvall.
As you surmised, Excel Energy
is
opposed
to
this bill. And I think for three principal reasons. First, the bill expands the personal property tax, which only utilities pay, to equipment that does not increase the productive value of the plant. It's a rifle shot tax increase against utilities. Only utilities are taxed on their personal property, and this bill would cause utilities to be the only industry taxed on their pollution control equipment. And the bill would add equipment to the tax rolls that does not produce electricity or increase our electric output. Second, the pollution control equipment is already subject to sales tax when it's acquired, so the bill would create multiple recurring taxation. Paying sales tax once up front should be enough. We shouldn't have to also pay a recurring property tax. And the added tax would raise the cost of electricity for our customers. And third, the bill is inconsistent with environmental policy and would raise the cost of compliance. Some 35 of 50 states would agree. They currently provide a pollution control property tax exemption of some type. A pollution control exemption serves an important purpose to avoid increasing the cost of environmental compliance through taxation. Otherwise, governments are asking taxpayers to pay more than once. For the reasons I've discussed, we believe it's appropriate to continue the pollution control exemption. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I only have I've got a couple questions for Mr. Duvall, if he doesn't mind fielding
sure.
them. One, you know, you referred to a sales tax portion in here, and you know, I'm trying to figure out where you're going to be increasing your sales tax payments at in the bill. But the other thing is that, you know, you talk about inconsistent with policies in so many other states. Do other states let power plants claim everything under the sun as pollution control equipment? Do they let plants claim safety injection pumps, residual heat removal pumps, component cooling heat exchangers, right down the line? I mean, do other states allow that?
Mr. Duvall, is there consistency among states and the sales tax increase?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, let's take those two questions just in the order that you offered them. First of all, the sales tax, there's no sales tax increase in your bill. There's an existing sales tax in the law right now. So there isn't a need to change the sales tax law. When the company buys or purchases pollution control equipment, it's subject to sales tax. So as I mentioned earlier, this is just another layer of tax on top of what we're already paying on our equipment.
But, Mr. Chairman, we have the replacement sales tax equipment exemption, and all the company needs to do is apply for that, and bingo. I mean, that one trumps everything else.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Murphy, the capital equipment exemption doesn't apply to pollution control equipment, and so we're paying. This would, in effect, put another layer of tax on our property.
Okay. Let's move to the consistency among states.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, as I mentioned, when I looked just quickly across what other states are doing in the property tax area, as I said, some 35 states exempt it. I think it's hard to say exactly how each state treats utilities, but I think the comment here, and as to what Senator Murphy said earlier when he said the problem is maybe with the Department of Revenue, I mean, everything that we claim an exemption on, we put on an exemption form, submit to the Department of Revenue for their audit. So this isn't equipment that we're just putting in our valuation and without any review. This is reviewed by the Department of Revenue before we actually get the exemption. So there is an audit process here. We feel everything that we do is consistent with the law, and so I don't think it's everything under the sun.
Mayor Howe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had a meeting with Mr. Duvall last Friday, and I'd like to use Mr. Duvall's argument on my personal vehicle as far as paying the sales tax and not having any reoccurring tax. The problem here is there's no transparency. The local entities do not understand or do not have the wherewithal or the financial resources to challenge anything that's labeled as pollution control exemption or the value that's attached to that. In that meeting, I asked if any local entity had challenged that, and the answer was they had not. And so that would lead one to believe that maybe some would, over the course of several decades or three decades, might get a little more aggressive on what they label as pollution control. And what the value that's attached to that. And I don't believe the Department of Revenue is a local entity understands the impact or the burden that that shifts to the local taxing authority. And so without correcting this, and the fairest way is to, if they want to recoup this on a rate rider, which I believe they've already put rate riders on for pollution control equipment, so they're already getting the funds from there, and then they're getting exemption on the backside. So we need to move this bill forward, It needs to have further discussion, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I agree. This is worth some more examination and discussion. I know with the Sherco plant, Xcel is throwing in quite a bit of pollution control equipment to get at mercury and particulates and some other, you know, they're kind of, as part of the mercury reduction bill, they're able to kind of wrap in some of those other measures. They're also able to wrap in some efficiency improvements at the plant, which is a good thing too, but also allows them to produce more energy at a lower cost. And I know we've had this whole conversation about personal property tax exemption, and we kind of hand them out as a matter of course to all utilities and certainly the independent power producers and the renewable energy, and need to take somewhat of a pause and take a look at this. But I do find myself a little torn. On the one hand, I'm a little cranky at Xcel because the mercury control equipment that they're throwing up isn't the highest and best. You know, they're making an argument that the economy is such that they're going to do the lesser technology that gets less mercury out, even though the better technology is available to them, claiming fiscal constraints. On the other hand, you know, so that causes me actually to be a little more sympathetic to Senator Murphy. On the other hand, I am worried, you know, are we going to inhibit their ability to do as good a job on this in the future? So, yeah, it's definitely, you know, and I'm certainly extremely sympathetic to what's going on in these utility communities. It's those charts are pretty compelling and pretty shocking. And if we don't maintain our commitment to that utility transition aid program, I don't know what Red Wing or Becker or some of those communities are gonna do.
And Senator Dibble, I don't know if the department's ready or to talk about this today, but I think at some point we're going to have to bring them into this discussion. And, you know, the department is the one that does the assessing. And so I'm curious as to how the interaction between the local unit that's supposed to be doing the appealing is going to play out. I think, Mayor, you're right. We need to take a delve into what's going on here. And Senator Murphy, and you know, we'll try to, you know, look at that in the weeks that are coming up before the tax bill moves forward. Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against Senate File 463? Mr. Folkman, the department.
As the department is coming forward, maybe we can plant a question, preview a question. This point that Senator Murphy makes about distinguishing, because, of course, the Sherco plan is wrapping this huge project into one, you know, some of the efficiency improvements with some of the pollution control improvements. And so if we agree that removing the personal property tax exemption for pollution control equipment is a good idea, which I'm not completely there yet, but if we do agree to that, are we distinguishing? Are we making that distinction inside the plant between the various types of equipment? Because this is one big, huge project, but it's got different components.
Well, and Senator Dibble, from what I've been listening to the testimony, perhaps that's where we're going to need to focus in and try to clarify the definition of what's eligible and what isn't, and make sure that that's clear. Mr. Folkman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And our state assessed property unit does have responsibility for valuing utility companies. But I just, you know, Senator Skoy, you'd mentioned that you would like to look at some more of the process that's involved here in terms of the determination of the exempt property and the valuation process. The Department of Revenue doesn't have we rely on the property on the PCA to let us know which equipment is actually qualifying for the exemption. We're sort of the middle person in the process, but I would like to be able to go back to my state assessed property unit and try and maybe sketch out the process in terms of what information we get from the company, the equipment's being identified. We send it then to the PCA for verification of what qualifies for exemption. It comes back to us, and that's how the process works. So I just was picking up on your last comment that I think we should have a discussion, because I often hear the department making these judgment calls, and it's not really us making the determination on what's exempt or not. But I think we need some visibility on that administrative process. So I'd like to just say for the record that we'll try and get back to you shortly here on sketching out that process and who the players are.
Great. We'll look forward to that information. Any other questions, members? Senator Murphy, we're going to lay Senate File 463 over for possible inclusion, and you know, we'll keep working on this with you and
sure.
See what we can come up with.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, lay Senate File 463 over. Senate File 1420. And very...
Mr. Chairman, I think that there's probably going to be the same host of people that are going to disagree on this bill as they did on the last one. And as a matter of fact, I think there might be more.
I think, Senator Murphy, we've got a list of people that want to testify that's a little longer on this one. But let's, the committee has heard this issue for the last 2 years. Pretty well informed on it, so if people can keep their testimony somewhat concise. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to let the mayor speak here briefly because he has some numbers that are quite disturbing. You know, these host communities, and you have a pipeline up in your neck of the woods, Mr. Chairman, so you know what the host communities or areas are having to deal with. You know, just about every utility across the nation has seen sometimes, you know, what we call massive tax cuts. Sometimes they've been more moderate. But every utility has seen some sort of tax advantage over the past few years. Does that mean that these utilities are doing good? Right now, no, they're not. There's not too many utilities that are making money hand over fist. So you can't beat them up too much. But in this regard, there has been, as far as power plants go and utility equipment, they've had several tax breaks over the past about 7 years now. And those tax breaks are disproportionate, in my opinion. Granted, their profits are down from where they were at 10 years ago. But, Mr. Chairman and members, we can't continue to erode the tax base in these host communities and expect for the communities to survive. Red Wing has seen a drastic decrease in the amount of tax that is paid to the city. There's representatives here from Goodhue County. They could tell you what it means for the county and the school districts. The same thing as in your area, Mr. Chairman. You know, all these units of government and our school districts are hurting, and to continue to pile on tax breaks for a business that may or may not need it is, I think, uncalled for in this time.
Well, thank you, Senator Murphy. And I my wife and I drive through Becker on the way back and forth, and she always says, gee, I can't imagine what it'd be like to live under this cloud. And so we know that there are impacts to host communities that have these plants, and part of this is to offset some of those impacts also. Mayor, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, in that regard, I just want to, as a former employee, I can also take pride in what XL does. And as a matter of fact, what a lot of the utilities all across Minnesota do in regards to protecting our environment. I do believe that these utilities go the extra mile to try to do that. And that should be rewarded. And I do believe that it is rewarded under our tax law, like the last bill we just talked about. You know, our tax law may be misapplied in certain areas, but I do believe that we need to recognize those improvements that XL and the rest of the utility industry has made in trying to clean up their smokestacks.
Mayor Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1420 on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities and the City of Red Wing. This committee is familiar with the background for this legislation, so I'll keep my remarks short. The Department of Revenue rule change will reduce the valuation of the Prairie Island nuclear plant by more than $126 million when fully phased in. which equates to a shift of $1.3 million in property taxes from the utility onto local businesses and homeowners. With the state facing a record $6.4 billion deficit, the need for a stable property tax is even more apparent. Since evaluations changes first took effect, the amount of state aids to the City of Red Wing has been certified to receive has increased by approximately $1,700,000 because of the decrease in its net tax capacity. In December, however, the City of Red Wing lost $570,000 in local government aid through the unallotment, and it appears likely that it may lose even more LGA over the next several years. We do not know yet whether the utility transition aid will be reduced this year or in future years. Given the projected budget deficits over the next two biennium, it appears that the utility transition aid is not a stable source for the city either. The utilities may argue that they're already taxed too much, but the fact is that public utilities are the only category of property to see their tax payments go down in recent years, declining by 2.8% from 2002 to 2008. In contrast, residential tax payments have increased by 82.4%, and commercial and industrial has increased by 32.3% during the same time period. Changing the classification rate for utility cities would negate the loss of net tax capacity resulted from the Department of Revenue rule changes. Equally important, it would provide more stable tax base that is not threatened by state budget cuts. We support the changing the rate effective for the tax payable in 2010, but also believe it's important to leave the transition aid in place for this year because our cities are relying on it for their budget and cannot levy back any loss in cities' current fiscal year. In 1995, Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant paid over $23 million in property tax. Last year, it was $10 million. When it comes to our school district in 1995, they paid $12 million in property tax. Last year, it was $1.9 million. So there's been a significant erosion of the benefit of a host community to have a nuclear generating plant in their city, not to mention nuclear waste storage in their community, too.
Thank you. Mayor Howe, you mentioned the transition aid. I'm going to break a rule. You're not supposed to ask a question you don't know the answer to, but I'm going to ask you the question. If you had to choose between the transition aid or Senate File 1420, the restoration of the class rate, do you have a preference on?
Well, obviously, I believe it would be the class rate change, but I don't believe this, again, is very moderate. I don't believe it goes far enough to cover or restore the tax base that we had. I mean, we need to go up from our 1995 levels, not down. And so this isn't going to get us back to where we were, 12 years ago, 13 years ago. So if that's what we're looking at, then I think we need to even increase it further.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chair, my friend Marshall Hollick, who is also the finance director for the City of Red Wing, could provide a little bit of testimony on that question.
Just Mr. Hall.
Thank you. In response to the chair's question.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Marshall Hollick with the City of Red Wing. Thank you. In support of what the mayor's earlier comments, too, we believe that if we had to make that choice that you presented, we would prefer this bill just because primarily to the fact of the stability inherent in having the legislation in place rather than in the current economic times where every other year there's a state budget deficit, which really throws all these aids into limbo and causes significant budgetary issues for the City of Red Wing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hallock.
Mr. Chairman, this
Senator
is just, this is what it means in a Red Wing. As you can see, the blue over here that shows a decrease, that's what the actual payments are that the local utility makes. So they've seen a decrease. Meanwhile, here's the 80% property tax increase over the past, I think, 15 years on this? Oh, no, not even. 6 years. I'm sorry. So you can see what happened to residential property,
yeah.
And you can see what happened over here on the blue line. So. Mr. Chairman, even those areas where they have seasonal rec, they haven't seen this. So
thank you, Senator.
It's an issue that needs to be addressed, Mr. Chairman, because You know, not only is the city and the county behind the eight ball on this, but our school district is really, really in tough, tough shape.
Questions, members? Senator Ball.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question in particular, but I have to. We've heard this bill many times, and I understand the background and the issue. But Mr. Mayor, the on allotment really is making this so crisp and so clear. And you know, oftentimes in this committee, we make all kinds of trade-offs, and we think that after everything nets out, that you'll be okay. But I gotta say that being a small city and staring at that on allotment, and then having this on you on top of that is. I can't imagine how you're trying to make the trade-offs where there are no more trade-offs to be made. And I don't even know how we'll go forward to try to address this, but I got to say I'm pretty sympathetic to
Thank
your
you,
situation.
Senator. And we are trying to address it, and unfortunately we're laying off police officers, we're laying off firefighters, and we've cut 12 public work positions. It's a very significant burden on our city.
Thank you. With that, I think we're going to move on the testimony. There, Ms. Bergen from Missouri River, Ms. Wright would like to testify. And then, members, in your packet, there's a letter from Alliance and another utility in opposition to this bill. I'd like to draw your attention to those letters that they have provided us. Ms. Bergen?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Senator Scully, members of the committee. My name is Deb Bergen. I'm manager of state legislative relations for Missouri River Energy Services. Missouri River Energy Services is a municipal power agency. Our headquarters are located in South Dakota, but we are comprised of 60 member municipal electric utility communities located in four states. North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and, of course, Minnesota. 24 of our 60-member communities are here in Minnesota. Right now, something that our communities are facing is not a surprise to any of you, and that's increased electric costs and increased electric rates. All 60 of our members get an allocation from the WAPA hydroelectric dams, and they have increased their rates by 18% over the last 2 years, and they've been informed that they will implement another rate increase in this coming year. Our CFO estimated that this bill will increase the taxes we pay on generation in Minnesota by 40%. Right now, we only have 6 wind turbines in Minnesota, but we have been looking to build more because Missouri River Energy Services is not only subject to the Minnesota RES, but also the South Dakota and North Dakota renewable energy objective. So we are in a building mode. Additionally, we are also a member of the CapEx 2020 project. We need to build additional transmission. These are all costs that will be to our members in addition to the increased cost of pay on power. So they are concerned with any increase in taxes because that comes right back in the rate base. And they're going to have increases because they have to pay for more generation in Minnesota, more generation in the other states to meet the RES, the REOs, and to pay for additional transmission to make it all come together. So that's why we are opposing this bill, because it's just one more leg on a stool that our municipal member communities have to pay for and bear.
And Ms. Bergen, you mentioned the transmission lines, and I've said this a number of times. I'm going to say it again here. You know, there's this huge controversy in this state about transmission lines, and you haven't been able to build any because of all the local opposition.
Yes.
You know, when the pipelines went through the community that I live in, one of the reasons that there was not a lot of local opposition is because of the local effort that they were going to make in support to our local communities, the schools and the counties. And as that commitment has gone away because of rate compression and other rule changes, there is more local opposition because the benefits are gone. And I think if you want to build transmission lines in Minnesota, perhaps a way to get around some of the local opposition is to be paying a part of these communities, and some of the local opposition might be less. Did you have a response, Ms. Berger? No, that's
no,
fine. It's a statement.
No response.
Ms. Wright.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Wright. I'm the property tax manager for Northern Natural Gas Company. We're an interstate natural gas pipeline located in 12 states, headquartered in Omaha. We have over 3,000 miles of pipeline here in the state of Minnesota. We have over 100 employees in the state. Last year, we paid over $7.6 million in property tax in 64 counties. I'm here today voicing our opposition to Senate File 1420. I've testified about four previous times in opposition to various versions of this bill. I was a member of the advisory committee working with the Department of Revenue drafting the new valuation rules, the purpose of which was to correct the systematic overvaluation and misapplication of appraisal rules in valuing public utilities. Previous versions of this bill were attempting to make whole the revenue losses to the various jurisdictions that were fearing a decrease in tax revenue. And as unfair as this is, it just does not apply to gas pipelines. And I also understand the transition aid bill helped allay some of those fears that those communities faced. Repeated analysis by the Department of Revenue shows that natural gas pipelines did not receive a valuation decrease under the rules. I have a graphic display that they prepared that shows, and I know you can't see it from there, but I have extra copies of this. The green areas show an increase in tax capacity after the phase-in of the rules and this proposed increase. They directly line up with natural gas pipelines across the state.
Well, Ms. Wright, those are crude oil pipelines.
No, these are natural gas pipelines.
The ones that runs in the Clearbrook is a crude oil pipeline. That's the green line running down through the northwest. And the reason it's green is because of all the expansion that's been gone on and the looping for increased capacity.
Well, these line up with Northern Border Alliance Pipeline and Great Lakes Pipeline. And we had a meeting here in St. Paul with the Department of Revenue last November, and I was not able to get that slide in time for this hearing, but Mr. Folkman's group would have it that showed, as a group, natural gas pipeline valuations went up under the new appraisal rules.
We'll, very good. We'll verify that.
So I just want to, again, express our opposition to this utility class increase as it would increase our taxes here in the state.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. Questions, members? Anyone else that wants to testify in favor of or in opposition to 1420? Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which has historically supported this legislation. I'm appearing today specifically on behalf of one of our members, Sherburne County, which is the host of the Sherco facility. They are on record as specifically supporting the increase in the class rates contained in 1420. I think for reasons that are obvious to the committee, they've suffered a substantial loss in tax base as a result of the class rate reductions that have been occurring since the 2001 reform, and would appreciate anything that could restore some of that loss to the community.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Hesse?
Oh, poor Hesse.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and Minnesota Chamber has historically opposed legislation like this because of the impact on electricity prices for our membership, and just wanted to be on the record in opposition to this again this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Bach.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hesse, now I'm going to assume that this House research information is accurate for the city of Redmond. And it shows that 2002 to 2008, residential homestead properties went up 82.4% in the city of Red Wing. CI went up 32.3%, but utilities went down 2.8%. Mr. Hesse, you think, is that how I read this? Is that?
Mr. Bach, Elizabeth Waffle from the firm of Flaherty and Hood. That was information drawn from statewide property taxes.
Statewide
property taxes, not just Red Wing. The front side, the back side is Red Wing.
Would you say your name again, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Elizabeth Waffle, W-E-F as in Frank, E-L.
So So,
Senator Bach.
So the 82.4% is what residential property taxes have gone up statewide?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're telling me that utilities in the same time period have gone down 2.8?
Yes.
And CI has gone up 32%?
Yes.
Statewide?
Yes.
So, Mr. Hesse, I'm confused why the business community would think it's okay for all the businesses' taxes to go up 32% and utilities to go down 2.8. I'm confused why that would be a good decision for the state chamber to come to.
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, our concern is the impact on electricity prices and any costs that you build into the cost of electricity will be passed on to customers. Our members all purchase electricity from some type of utility, and the legislature has added a variety of costs over the years, the last several years, with various mandates on that driven up the price of electricity. Our view is that on the tax side, that will have the same effect, and again, we're concerned with the cost of electricity to our membership.
Mr. Chairman, I just wish my home had been treated like the Prairie Island plant. Because I think I can about guess what my property taxes were in 1994. According to this, Prairie Island's property taxes are half what they were in 1994. I don't know what exponentially mine have gone up, but multiple of times they have doubled since 1994. And it just seems, something doesn't seem right that one class of property actually pays half of what they paid in 94, and a homeowner pays exponentially 2, 3, 4 times more. Something doesn't seem just quite fair about that. I'm just having a hard time understanding why, if the test of good tax policy is fairness, something doesn't seem right. Something's out of balance. Senator Murphy, can you help me understand why?
Senator Murphy, we're going to move on. Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I scratch my head, too, because I don't believe that the fairness factor applies in this area. And when it comes to utilities, you know, everything from pipelines to the electrical lines hanging out on the pole to the, you know, underground power plants, the whole gambit, you know, you know, Department of Revenue and the PCA, they have a hard time because they don't understand, you know, the true value of what the equipment is, and they don't understand what the true purpose of the equipment is. And so it's almost impossible to come up with a good tax statement for any place, whether it was Becker or the pipeline up in your neck of the woods or the plant in Red Wing. You know, I feel sorry for Mr. Hesse coming here because he's got actually, I do. This is one time I feel bad for the chamber. Because they've got constituents on both sides of this issue. You know, these drastic drops in the payments that utilities make because we've, you know, completely eroded that portion of tax base has a lot of effect on the members of the chamber, because in Red Wing, the chamber members that own businesses downtown get to pay more property taxes because the big brother that lives out at Prairie Island pays less. And so, you know, our businesses, especially our small businesses in town, you know, they get to pay more, and XL gets to pay less, and so so does our residential, and you know, so it just doesn't make sense, and we need to get this cleaned up quickly, because Red Wings and Beckers are coming to your hometown next.
Yep. Senator Murphy, we've got one more person mm-hmm. to give some testimony here, and then we're going to move on. So, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand this out.
You're not on my list. You'll have to state your name, and we'll get a page to come there. So.
Teresa Feinberger.
This is, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Mr. Reinberger, I apologize.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Joe Reinberger, and I'm with Xcel Energy's Tax Department. Thank you for giving me time on your agenda today. I'm here to speak in opposition to the proposed utility property tax class rate increase contained in Senate File 1420. The bill calls for a 40% class rate increase for electric generation equipment, as well as a 12.5% increase for electric transmission and distribution equipment, resulting in an increase in our annual property taxes of about $20 million. The bill is a response to the correction in 2007 of the Department of Revenue's utility company valuation rule. Besides any increase in taxes that will be passed on to our ratepayers at a time when our economy is in recession, Xcel opposes enactment of these provisions for three main reasons. First, due to ongoing capital investments we are making at our plants, the new DOR rule is not having the anticipated effect on host community revenues, and projected investments will ensure their tax bases continue to grow. Number two, as Senator Moa alluded to earlier, utility transition valuation aid legislation passed during the 2008 session already covers cities experiencing tax revenue lost due to the revised rule. And number three, Xcel initiated discussions with host communities to enter into revenue stabilization agreements in order to cushion them in the event their property taxes decreased as a result of the rule change. Let's go back to number one. Due to significant ongoing capital investments we are making in our plants, the corrected DOR rule is not having the anticipated effect on our host community revenues. This is evidenced already in the first 2 years of the new DOR rule. Overall, there's an increase in tax at three of our five largest plants for pay 2009, with slight decreases at the other two. At our King plant in Oak Park Heights, for example, our tax bill increased 100% from $1.9 million in pay 07 to $3.8 million in pay 09. In the future, host community tax bases will continue to grow even more as Xcel makes additional projected investments. Let's talk about the chart that was handed out. The top line is the level of property taxes over the past 4 years and projected to pay 2010. It incorporates planned net taxable investments by Xcel, ignores all other tax-based growth, and factors in full implementation of the new DOR rule. The lower line is the approximate level of tax we would have paid if we were taxed like other businesses in the state, that is taxed only on land and buildings. The difference is the personal property tax. Approximately 75% of what we pay is personal property tax. Communities that host power plants benefit by far the most from the personal property tax. The main point of the graph is that it clearly illustrates that despite full implementation of the new DOR rule in pay 2010, without any utility class rate increases such as the ones contained in Senate File 1420, and even without any growth in communities where our plants are located, our taxes are projected to actually increase to levels paid before the new rule was implemented. The second reason we oppose Senate File 1420 is because utility transition valuation aid legislation passed during the 2008 session already covers cities experiencing revenue loss due to the revised rule. As you know, the 2008 legislature established utility valuation transition aid, which provides aid to a city indefinitely for tax-based loss due to the Minnesota Department of Revenue's rule change. With this aid in place, it's unnecessary to increase the utility class rates. In pay 2009, it's my understanding the city of Red Wing, for example, will receive about $750,000 in this type of aid and about $1.5 million in pay 2010. Final reason why we oppose Senate File 1420 is Xcel initiated discussions with host communities to enter into revenue stabilization agreements in order to cushion them in the event their property taxes decreased as a result of the rule change. The Department of Revenue corrected its utility company valuation rule in 2007 in order to create a soft landing for communities impacted by a change of the rule. The DOR added a three-year phase-in, 20% for pay 2008, 50% for pay 2009, and 100% for pay 2010. In addition to the phase-in, which we supported, Xcel felt the corrected rule would have an impact on the communities most affected and where we constitute a large part of the tax base. So the company initiated discussions to enter into revenue stabilization agreements with these communities. The City of Red Wing and Goodhue County were two of the communities Xcel approached. In November 2006, Xcel signed agreements with the City of Red Wing and Goodhue County, whereby the company would provide stabilization payments to these local government units for a period of 10 years in the event their property taxes decreased because of the rule change. In 2008, Xcel made stabilization payments to Red Wing and Goodhue County in the amount of $18,605 and $176,641, respectively. Though the agreement with the city was terminated due to the passage of the utility valuation transition aid legislation I spoke about earlier, the agreement with Goodhue County is still in force. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reinberger. And maybe you get us a copy of your testimony. We can pass that out. Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reinberger, the utility transition aid is intended to hold cities whole, but I don't believe we addressed the issue of counties.
Mr. Reinberger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, the counties were addressed in the revenue stabilization argument I made. They are the counties most affected by the rule change, and we've identified Goodhue County, Sherburne County, and Wright County as those communities. There is an offer to enter into revenue stabilization agreements with those communities. The only revenue stabilization agreement we do have signed with a county is Goodhue County.
Senator Murphy, and then we're going to lay Senate File 1420 over for possible inclusion. Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, I just need to respond to some of the testimony that was provided by Xcel. You know, the mention of King Plant and the property taxes going up at King Plant and the overall amount of property taxes that Xcel and some other utilities pay, you know, there's claims being made that those are increasing. And that is more than likely true, but just like at King Plant, with the retrofit that was done there, that plant is worth more money now. I mean, there was a major investment put there, and so, yeah, you are going to pay more. I don't think that that's a real good argument. The last thing that I want to say, Mr. Chair, is that this is a rule about taxation. Now, don't you think the public in Minnesota would go nuts if they knew that their property taxes were increasing because of a rule and not a law? Who are they supposed to go talk to about a rule? The last time I checked is when there's a law passed, the rule follows the law. This rule doesn't follow the law. It went out on its own. We all know that.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm sick and tired, Mr. Chairman, of trying to defend this rule to my constituents, as I'm sure you are too. This rule is not a good rule.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Seeing no more questions and no other comments, Chair lays Senate File 1420 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, testifiers.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Clark. Senator Clark, I understand you have a consensus bill that everybody is supportive of and in agreement with. So we have a number of bills behind you. So we'd appreciate it if you'd keep this short.
Really quickly, if that would be your pleasure. We have people here who certainly can be helpful and testify. But Mr. Chair, you're correct. This is just to remind people. This is.
Take your conversations outside, please. Senator Clark.
Last year we passed a moratorium for on the tax status, the tax exempt status for nonprofits. There's been a lot of work done. I'm sure you would hear about the many, many hours done trying to make sure that we could do something in statute, because there's never been anything in statute about this. It's been case law to try to reflect what the intent originally was of the North Star case, but not contract or expand. And at this point, we believe that that's where we're at. We know there's a couple of issues that we might need to keep working on along the way, but would you like us to quickly just go through what we've done in this?
Sure, Senator Clark. Just quickly go through what you've done, and then we'll get testimony and hear from the department.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Clark, thank you for the opportunity to walk through Senate File 751 with all of you. With the legislative charge from the moratorium last year to neither expand nor contract, but to rather provide clarity and consistency for both nonprofits and county assessors, the Department of Revenue, county assessors, Minnesota Council of Nonprofit, in consultation with nonprofit attorneys, legislative staff, and others, set forth to codify but modify the North Star factors that had been the precedent for over 33 years. And with this goal in mind, we began. And if you look through the legislation, you'll notice that there are still six factors, and those are modifications or the original six factors from the North Star case that had become the precedent for determining whether an organization is eligible for property tax exemption as a purely public charity. We left numerous factors alone, as they are already required for 501c3 determination, and that's something that the assessors looked at. So factors 1, 4, 5, and 6 are mostly left alone. The meat of our negotiations and conversations were around factors 2 and 3, which have to do with income and how services are rendered to community members. And in this, we modified factors 2 and 3 to become more current with assessment practices by adding in factor 2, government grants, which is defined in accordance with other state statute, and in factor 3 to formally add the alleviation of burdens of government, which was already used as a sub-factor for another factor. So all these six factors are to be satisfied under this legislation. However, given the diversity and the breadth of the nonprofit sector and currently exempt charities, assessors maintain some discretion in granting exemption with some justification for a missing factor if there's a strong case to do so. All the way through this process, this was checked through a list of commonly exempt organizations.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. And I would like to thank the committee for hearing this, allowing me to testify on this. And I'd just like to briefly explain what an extremely arduous task this was in trying to reach consensus on this. And we had, I believe Ms. Avner will be testifying, that we had 13 meetings or 14 meetings and 24 different drafts of this bill, I believe. To say we had a lot of arguments might be overstating a little bit, but there were certainly some contentious meetings we had. And quite honestly, I was amazed at the end. And in retrospect, I was sort of amazed we were able to bring this all together and reach accord with the assessors, the Department of Revenue, and the Council of Nonprofits. And nobody, I think one of the good tests of how good this language might be is that at the end of the day, nobody was particularly thrilled with it. Everybody was willing to embrace it and be guardedly optimistic that it would work. But everybody had a few minor concerns, which probably tells us we're just about where we should be with the language. And as Senator Clark mentioned, our charge going into this was to neither expand or contract the existing landscape. We worked really, really hard on the language, and we got to the point where we were fighting about periods and commas and government payments and government grants and what would happen. And everybody... The conclusion on all of us was that if the wording was wrong, it was the results would be disastrous. That either everybody would be exempt or everybody would be taxable. So in that environment, we finally crafted the language and spent an awful lot of time working on it. And because of that, we're very, very guarded and very reluctant to have any changes to the language. Having said that, we still believe there are two areas that there is a little bit of exposure on two groups. Nursing homes are one. And we are actually advocating separate language that would exempt nursing homes, a line item exemption for nursing homes, primarily because nursing homes are pretty much all structured the same. They all function pretty much the same. and I believe all nursing homes in the state, with the exception of 7 for-profit nursing homes, are currently exempted. So we would like a line item exemption on that. There's also some discussion, some concern over group homes. And group homes aren't as easy, in my estimation, to define or to identify as nursing homes because they're structured differently and they function so very much differently. We are currently working on trying to identify some tweaking of the language potentially that might give more comfort to the group home people. And certainly most of the group homes that are currently exempt, I do believe, should properly be exempt. One final thing that we did because of the concern over changing the landscape and maybe properties that weren't exempt becoming taxable and vice versa, we proposed in our recommendation to or our report to the legislature, we proposed the establishment of a three-member review board. And I guess in the report we actually recommended establishing that, and I guess I'd probably like to make a commitment that we are committed to establishing this review board. And the purpose of the review board, the review board would be composed of one representative of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, a representative of the Department of Revenue, and a representative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And we would be available to offer non-binding recommendations on taxation or exemption, which could be brought to us either by a county or by a property owner. And the desire, although it would be non-binding, so it wouldn't diminish any of the appeal opportunities for these groups, it would hopefully diminish the amount of appeals to tax court and add a lot of certainty about the properties being more consistently assessed throughout the state. Additionally, we would think that the function of this review board would be to look for any unintended consequences, and if we identified any that might exist, we would be in a position to recommend a legislative change to reflect that change.
Thank you, Mr. Hagen. Ms. Avner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Avner. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I will keep my comments brief, but we appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Many of you have signed on to the bill, and all of you, have met with constituents and our staff about this issue, and we really thank you. We are very proud to be able to bring to you today what the chair has referred to as a consensus bill, in that we really have worked very hard to reach a core, to be reasonable, and to meet that legislative mandate to neither expand nor contract the property tax exemption. We do think we have a very reasonable accord here. We appreciate the department's commitment to the panel and to a very clear directive to assessors to bring what nonprofits need: real consistency and clarity about what allows a nonprofit to be determined to be a purely public charity eligible for the tax exemption. So on behalf of our almost 2,000 members, we are really grateful for the ability to reach this agreement. It's very important to nonprofits that their resources be dedicated to the programs and services that people count on in communities. And we appreciate the process that we have been through. It really has been 15 meetings and 24 drafts. We thank all of you, and especially Ms. Off, for helping us with this. So thank you,
Ms. Avner, and Senator Clark and the department. We all thank you for your effort. We know this is kind of a thorny issue. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if 15 meetings are enough yet. Mr. Hagen, I'm a little nervous about lines 2.4. We got a 6-test factor. I understand that. But then we create an exemption on line 2.4 that you can drive a truck through. With reasonable justification, you can have missed 3 of the factors. Maybe we have a definition of reasonable justification in statute, but seems like a pretty big hole in being able to avoid half 3 of the 6 factors. Can you explain to me what reasonable justification might be in the eyes of an assessor?
Mr. Hagen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I probably can't do a real good job explaining what reasonable justification is. Our expectation in developing it and agreeing to that language, and Mr. May, I believe, could maybe speak to this too, was to, again, not change the landscape. Let me give you an example of why we came to this point. We talked about, and we've discussed and argued so many times about if all the points had to be determinative and if they had to meet all the points. But there was properties that fall outside of the North Star factors, which we would clearly look at, and Mr. May often talks about a test he uses, without speaking for Mr. May, that a test he uses in exempting properties, he'll look at it and you pretty much get a feel for it. It's sort of like a farm. Like we've said for years, we can't necessarily tell you what a farm is, but when you see a farm, you know it's a farm. And in sort of the same analogy as is used on some of the nonprofits, after Under the Rainbow, the court case, the Supreme Court decision on Under the Rainbow, it required that there had to be something given away, and it has specified more, gave more determination to some of the North Star factors, which we had always held had to be met in the first place. There's a property, a brain trauma injury center near Duluth, which would fail a number of the North Star tests. They you would look at them, and you would certainly conclude that a brain trauma injury center where they treated a homeless person that jumped off a bridge and landed on a corporate executive, they'd be treated exactly the same, irrespective of their ability to pay for services. One would think that would be an exempt entity, but at the same time, they take government payments. They don't have donations in all likelihood. They don't really give anything away. So if you applied the direct North Star standards without any potential for reasonable justification, that property would be taxable. There's a number of other instances like that. Group homes comes to mind. There is some exposure, as I mentioned, in group homes. What we hope the reasonable justification will work in concert with the advisory committee or the review board, and really everyone's commitment that we don't want to expand or contract. I do expect there will be some properties that are currently taxed that will probably become exempted, a few group homes. We have situations in one county, group homes. I spoke to a gentleman down in a county yesterday who they own group homes in three different counties. Two of them structured the same, run exactly the same. Two of the counties exempt them, one taxes them. We would like to get that kind of clarity and certainty and uniformity so that they're all treated the same. And we hope that because everybody is not trying to change the landscape and we think the assessors will take direction from us, and particularly with the advent of the advisory board or the review board, that we can shepherd the reasonable justification through without any absurd consequences or any changes in the assessment. And if it doesn't work, our expectation would be to come back to the legislature and try to get legislative change.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. We're going to get Mr. May up here. Why don't you pull your chair up alongside Mr. Hagan? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I can wait till after Mr. May's testimony.
Mr. May.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. First of all, we truly do appreciate being involved in the process over the last year to come to some consensus on language. And I think the prior testimony indicate that it's not language that any one party is fully happy with. There's issues that we would have liked to seen different, but it is a compromise we think that accomplishes what we set out to do. And for assessors, the real issue is to better define purely public charity and point to those properties that should qualify for property tax exemption. Secondly, to provide consistency statewide. And thirdly, we hope it'll help reduce litigation in this area in Minnesota tax court. And in that regard, we think that the advisory panel that the department is recommending is a good idea. And in the bottom line for us is we hope that through the whole process, we've met the goal to neither expand nor contract what we typically do with the exemptions in this area. And with that, I'd answer any questions you might have.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I feel ecstatic that folks have worked through and are coming up with a consensus bill. And I met with Ms. Avner and folks yesterday to understand it a little bit better. And, of course, John Pratt, I have to recognize, as head of the Council on Nonprofits and my constituent. Welcome to the committee. However, since then, some concerns have been raised, probably moving in a slightly different direction than Senator Bach's concern, and that's those instances where a municipality owns a property or some public entity owns a property, and they contract with a 501c3 to operate the service in that particular property and a service that that property is intended for, and otherwise the public entity would be carrying out. And I'm, of course, to stop being abstract, I'm talking about instances where we provide bonding for a particular facility, and then we contract with the 501c3 to carry that out. That could be a theater type or a cultural offerings, that sort of thing, that don't really fall into, when we think about the council nonprofits, social service agencies, but venues that are available to the public on a not-for-profit basis. So can we be sure that those would continue to receive that exemption?
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Hagan, Ms. Evner, who's going to be best?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dribble, if I understand the question correctly, I think you're asking the question if a governmental entity owns a particular property and then contracts or has a nonprofit operate
their
charity in that facility, would it be exempt? I guess I can answer that question and tell you the way that we would look at that. Typically, exemption requires two things: ownership by a qualifying entity and use by a qualifying entity. And in that case, we would look at a qualifying entity as a governmental entity owning the property. Then we would look towards who operates a property and to see if they had owned the property themselves, if they would qualify. So they still have to meet all the standards, but they have to meet it in as their organization.
And
Ms. Abner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, we provided each of you with a list of the organizations in different parts of the state that are currently exempt. And that list does include those organizations that secured money through the bonding process, in which case it is a public entity that owns the property, but it is a 501c3. And we did have some questions about why cities are included in those lists, and it's for just that reason. So it would cover the organizations that I think you're concerned about.
Senator Dibble.
I think just to follow up. And so as I heard the testimony, I just want to confirm that I heard it correctly. The determination would continue as it is today. The county assessors would make these determinations. That's correct. But there's this advisory body that we're going to perhaps set up to kind of do a pre-appeal effort.
Mr. Hagan and then Senator Clark.
Our expectation is that the advisory committee would rule on the more gray areas, because we have concluded in all our discussions there's just no good way to identify language that allows everybody to connect the dots and get to the right place. So there will be some properties that fall outside into the gray area that assessor or the property owner feels they're not being treated fairly. And that's where the review panel would come into play.
Senator
Dibble.
Just a final statement. I think I'm hearing what I need to hear, but I would appreciate some opportunity as we continue to look at this to make sure entities like, the Duluth Aquarium or the Science Museum or Downtown Theaters.
Senator Dibble, we're laying these on the table. We'll be putting the property tax article together in a couple weeks. We certainly expect that if there's issues with these bills, we'll be working on them in the intervening time. So, we can address those issues with all the bills that we've laid over. We expect multiple of them that some of them has issues we're going to keep working on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, our intent, and I've talked with the chair about this, is that as we also move to full committee, there are a couple of small things that we think might need to be addressed anyways. The group home language, I hope that we can figure out what the right language is, and I know that there's a possibility with the nursing home in a different way to be dealing with that. I think it's important that we remember, and I was trying at the beginning to be very concise because I know how long you took with the last bill and you've got other bills to go to, but the Constitution provides for the tax exemption of purely public institutions. And so what we're trying to do because of what happened with Under the Rainbow, which I think Ms. Off and I would agree was decided appropriately for that particular situation, it put a whole lot of things into question. And then after working with the assessors, we found out there was a lot of variation about what was happening. Not to say there weren't some good things happening there. So I know that you all understand how hard it is when you're looking at specific words. The amount of time it took to get to the words material, for example, was significant. And so, just even from a legal standpoint, I think that there's a lot of what's in here is going to be helpful. I also personally believe that that advisory board is going to be very important because there could be some things that come up that there could be agreement that perhaps we need to come back and relook at the language in the future. But we believe that this gives enough guidance that the assessors ought to be able to be moving forward. And my understanding, and you two could correct me if I'm wrong, is that the list that everybody has been given that's been compiled about each of our areas, that those are going to fall within this, at least as they currently exist. They may be modifications along the way if they do not continue their purposes, but they would meet this threshold test.
Thank you, Senator Clark. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to any of the witnesses. Could we probe lines 119 and 120 just a second? And as I read that, and there may be some legal ways to interpret that language, but if I just simply read it from the standpoint of how one might interpret it on the street, whether the income received, including material gifts, which sounds like some sort of an item, and donations, which to me sounds like cash or money, produces a profit, and that sounds like money, that the charitable institution profit to the charitable institution that is distributed to the private interest. So that sounds to me, at least in a street sense, to be you qualify for the exemption if you give money to a private interest, whoever that is.
Senator Senjum, I think I heard the first testifier say that they kind of left 1, 4, 5, and 6 alone and focused on 2 and 3, but we can certainly, Ms. Abner, can you answer the question, Senator Senjum's question?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, item number 4 is part of the long-held definition of what a nonprofit is. And what this means is that there are no profits that accrue to any individual shareholders. So the question becomes whether or not there is any profit that goes to any private individual. You can't even be a 501c3 nonprofit if that's the case. And so this is simply has been standard law since the IRS code developed and was the language used in the North Star test. It simply means you have to be a nonprofit. You can't be a profit-making, shareholder, returning entity. The word profit is often confusing to people in this context, okay. And we really could not identify a way to make it any clearer than it is in the original North Star language. And so it's simply a further way of underscoring what constitutes nonprofit status.
Members, I think we are going to now lay Senate file number 751 over for possible inclusion.
Mr. May, I asked counsel if we have anywhere in statute reasonable justification. We've got that on line 2.4 and 2.5. I mean, to an assessor, what does that mean, and is there a better word than that?
Mr. May.
You're just trying to make your job a little easier?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, you've heard from previous testimony why that was put in there, because there are some fairly public charities that may not meet all 6, and there's a lot of different areas. Some are the arts, some are other areas. But it's put in there so that we can look at it and see if there's something in the way that organization operates that would allow them to still be a charity without meeting that. And when we look at these, it's really a pretty in-depth look, because we'll look at their Form 990s, which have a wealth of information about all their financials, you know, where their funds come from, where they go, and so forth. And there might be some reasons in some of these cases that they don't meet all 6. And so that was why that was put in there. Whether there's better language, it makes it tighter. For us, we're hoping that revenue can define that well for us.
Members, we will continue this discussion when we put the article together. These folks are all around the Capitol, all that we can get in contact with them. We do have people that have traveled, and this day has gone on much longer than I thought. So we're going to lay Senate File 751 on the table for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Clark.
Thank you
all. Senator Reston, we're going to be fast on these two, I hope.
Must, because on the back side we do.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start with Senate File 828, and there's an author's amendment.
An amendment to 828.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members, the bill deals with the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program. Started in passed in 1971, really started after a lot of court action in 1975, and it is the, it's called fiscal disparities, but it is the Metropolitan Revenue Distribution Program. In the bill as introduced, it also included the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program, but in the amendment offered, they are excluded in it. And the original proposal was to get rid of the so-called lag year. The lag year indicates that all of the formulas and calculations used for both getting to the contributions of that 40% of growth that goes into the fiscal disparities pool of commercial industrial property in the metropolitan area, and the distribution formulas and rates are all a year behind. That is a distortion in the system, and what we are proposing in the amendment, and I have met with the particularly the people that are the administrative auditors for the program each year, or each 2 years? Every 2 years, one of the auditors of the seven-county metropolitan area is elected to administer the program. Since its beginning, that's always been in the Anoka in Anoka County. And what we are asking in this amendment then is to continue the lag year for the contribution side of the program, but to ask the administrative auditor for the program to come up with a working model to get rid of the lag year on the distribution side, which is where most of the distortion occurs. And so Ms. Joan Flavin, who is the property tax supervisor here from Anoka County, is prepared to answer questions or I think she would also say that this is workable for them to do this by, I think we asked for it to come up with a working model by February 1st of 2012, and then it would then be put in place in 2014, and it would allow the legislature, obviously, if the working model that they come up with it is not appropriate, it would allow us to either extend the date later or to be resigned to the distortion in the system.
And Senator Ress, so what the goal of this Senate file is to use more current data when
that's
you're
correct
analyzing
on the distribution side
distribution
right now
fiscal
it's
disparities.
All lagged by a year, and so there ends up sometimes being a roller coaster effect because everything is a year behind. And we did that at the beginning because it was difficult to meet the timelines of getting all the information and the data, and then that was further complicated by the truth in taxation deadlines that were put into place in the early 90s. With more technology available, easier collection of data, we believe that this is a time to move forward on getting rid of that distortion and doing current year calculations with regard to the distribution of fiscal disparities dollars.
Thank you. Questions, members? And Ms. Flavin?
My name is Joan Flavin, and I'm the property tax supervisor for Anoka County, and I also, Maureen Devine, is the administrative auditor, but I am one of the technical people that works with fiscal disparities.
Okay, thank you. Question? Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, are we still on the amendment? Or that adopted?
We have not adopted the amendment.
May I make a request to the author?
Sure. Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, This has come up a couple times in the Energy Committee, but on line 1-4, would you be opposed to, after the word chairs, including the words and ranking minority members?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Senator St. John. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. No objection whatsoever. And I would include that language if council could draft it quickly in my author's amendment.
Senate Council will incorporate and minority member.
Ranking minority.
Mr. Chair.
Ranking minority member.
Yeah.
In the language. And then, Senator St. John, would you want to move the A1 amendment for Senator Rest?
With that change, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move the A1 amendment.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 The same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I've explained what the intent of the amendment is, and to the extent that that is achieved by this language, that would be the bill.
Any other questions? Senator Moore.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, in a lot of the reports that we were requiring, we're asking that it be in electronic format unless the written copy is requested. So I would like you to consider that. And I don't know if you want to make that change here or if you would be open to that. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, I have no difficulty with that, but perhaps I could work with Senate Council before the bill is put together.
Yes.
That would have that language, because I don't have that language with me today.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Moore, we can work and put that in when we're putting the bill together. Any other discussion? Chair LA Senate file 828 over for possible inclusion as amended. Thank you, Senator Rest. And Senator Rest, you've got a levy limit bill, Senate file 1047. As you know, in the full committee, we have a bill that repeals all of the levy limit provisions, so that would certainly go considerably beyond what Senate file 1047 does. But we'll briefly hear what you've got in
Thank
Senate
you,
file 1047.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a couple of people who could answer questions. Current law allowed for local governments to levy a special levy to recapture the loss that they experienced under an allotment. Current law does not allow, as I understand it, and sometimes I get these confused, does not allow for a special levy for aids, a local government aid that would be cut in 2009. Current law does allow for a local government to have a special levy for an aid cut, an LGA cut, aid cuts in 2010. Current law does not allow for those cities that are affected by market value credit to have a special levy mitigating the loss of market value credit in either 2000 or 2009 or 2010. And what the bill does going forward, and I would, if we're not able to repeal levy limits, I would certainly hope that this proposal would be considered. And what it would do would be to allow, unlike current law, it would be to allow the local governments to have a special levy to take into account the aid loss in 2009, and it would allow local governments that are affected by losses in market value credit in 2009 to have a special levy in 2010, and also if there was a market value credit loss in 2010, to allow for 2011 a special levy to accomplish that. So the difference is that market value credit special levies would be brought into the system, and for the LGA cuts, that they would be able to have a special levy for 2010 to, and I guess it's actually an adjustment of the levy limit is what it really is, for 2010 that would account for any aid cuts in 2009 and 2010. And in addition, one other little thing is has to deal with the implicit price deflator, so that there is the levy limit calculation is based on the notion that that never goes below zero, and we put it in the bill is that regardless of it does go below zero, we're not going to go below zero. And I think that's been suggested by some of our tax analysts as well as by the local governments. But that's what the bill does. It allows some more flexibility with regard to special levy authority in the event of aid cuts and not being able to repeal levy limits. And, Mr. Chairman, as an author's amendment, I have the A1 amendment, which the Department of Revenue has requested as a as comfort language for them.
Senator Bach moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson is here, but also I have a mayor that I would like to have just give some brief testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor, and if you could be concise.
I will try to be that. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. I'm Mike McGuire, and I'm proud to serve as the mayor of Eagan and the chair of the Municipal Legislative Commission. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you in support of Senator Rest's Senate File 1047, and I'll try to be brief in doing that. As you know, the Municipal Legislative Commission is a collection of 14 metro area communities that do not receive local government aid but do, at least in theory, participate in the Homestead Market Value Credit Program. As Senator Rest noted, current state statute prohibits cities like ours from levying back losses from partial or complete unallotment from the state or legislative changes to those state aid programs. The Municipal Legislative Commission supports Senate File 1047 because it amends this area of statute to allow for a special levy if aids and credits are lost due to unallotment or reductions enacted by the legislature in 2009 or 2010. I'd like to just briefly remind the committee that in five of the last 7 years, one or both of these things has happened, and the state has failed to reimburse communities like ours, as they should, including this past December's gubernatorial unallotments. With 3 days left in the local government fiscal year, those unallotments created a spontaneous deficit in Eagan and in cities and towns throughout Minnesota. We support Senate File 1047 and thank Senator Rest for authoring it because we believe local spending decisions are best made by locally elected and locally accountable officials who are, I would argue, more sensitive to the value that their constituents have for local services. I want to be clear that our MLC community's support for Senate File 1047 should not be taken as a guarantee that our cities will levy back such losses. We are sensitive to our taxpayers' property tax burdens, and this bill protects taxpayers by making the levy back language an option for cities and not a mandate to them. It is an important option to be available to cities so that they have the option of maintaining basic and valued services for their constituents. Again, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address this bill, and I can remain available for any questions as you please.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson can answer questions. Okay. He doesn't need to testify.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, there's a bill later in the agenda that I have that I'd like you to take a look at because I think it may be a little better, a more timely approach. Senate File 520 would allow a city to sell an emergency debt certificate in the event that they lose some state aid and then have the authority to levy back to pay for that debt instrument, which might actually be a little faster response time for a city to, I think, accomplish what you're trying to do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, does that also affect the loss of market value credit?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I know this is a Senate File 520 is also supported by the League of Cities. I guess I would like it if the if this bill could be laid over and to compare the two and go forward with whatever is the preferred approach, and I'd be very pleased with that.
Well,
as long as this one would still stay in the mix.
Well, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, let me just suggest, Senator Rest, take a look at Senate File 520.
Okay.
and see if it maybe accomplishes the same thing, and maybe
okay, I'm on the
talk,
bill,
with, so talk with the league about it. And we right. may not. It could be we don't need both.
Okay, we'll come back with a recommendation as to which one affects most cities with the best flexibility and the least costs.
And keep in mind that we have a full levy limit repeal.
I understand,
in the,
and
in
I absolutely
committee.
Support that, as you know.
Thank you, Senate File or Chair lays Senate File 1047 as amended over for possible inclusion. While we're on levy limits, we're going to do Senator Johnson very quick. She has also a bill dealing with special levies. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. This is, again, as you said, a special levy. It's for the MIPAD project, the Tri-County Forensic Lab in Anoka County. I did hear you suggest that we'll possibly be raising the levy limits, so I'm also in agreement with that. But just in case, you never know how it's going to play out, I'd like to include this in the omnibus bill. Lona Schreiber's here from the county to show support from the county board. And Kevin Peterson is here as a finance manager if we have any questions regarding the financing.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kevin Peterson, and I'm the finance division manager for Anoka County. We were fortunate to receive state support last year through a $3 million bonding appropriation towards the forensic laboratory being built and incorporated into this public safety campus. The forensic lab portion of the facility will be shared by two other counties, Sherburne and Wright. The rest of the facility will house the sheriff, administrative staff, our criminal investigation division, the patrol division for county patrol, and the contracted city and township patrols, the warrants function, the SWAT unit, the boat and water safety unit, and other functions. The facility will also have a community room which will be available to the public for meetings and other functions. We estimate the annual operations and maintenance cost to be approximately $510,000. In front of you should be a handout showing our calculations on the overall levy and the impact on a typical $200,000 residence in Anoka County. The construction of this facility and its eventual opening were timed to coincide with a reduction in overall debt service levy. The debt service will drop in 2010. As the bonds we issued in 1998 for our government center will be paid off. 2009 is the last levy year for that issue. The debt service levies for the new building and the levy for its operations and maintenance are less than the reduction in our debt service levy for the government center. However, the issue comes down to the levy subject to limit versus the levy exemption from levy limits debt service. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And as Senator Johnson indicated, you know, we do have the repeal of the levy limits in the Senate bill, but we certainly will consider this language if for some reason we're not able to. And as we move forward through this session, we'll see where this ends up. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, just to reiterate what Mr. Peterson said, this will have a zero effect because they'll be retiring some old bonds. Also, it is not language specific, so if there's any other concerns out in the state, they could be included.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Sorry that we kind of got ourselves in a little time constraint. Chair lays Senate File 980 over for possible inclusion. Members, Senator Erickson Ropes has folks from Lanesboro. I think we should hear their testimony, and then we can continue on with these two Senate files at our next meeting. And I do apologize for filling up the agenda a lot more than I should have. I didn't realize that we were going to go quite so long on some of the earlier bills. Senator Erickson Ropes, and as you know, we are in caucus, so we'll have to keep this brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, do you just want to take the testimony of my witnesses now, or do you want to talk about the bill?
I think if you would briefly introduce the bill, and then we'll take the testimony. And then I think at our next meeting, we'll ask you to come back and continue the discussion and questions with members, if you would be okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, we've been working on this bill for a couple of years and had the opportunity of Senator Bach come down to Lanesboro and try to help us with a problem that Lanesboro's been dealing with for the last couple of years. They have become a seasonal rec community, but are kind of getting tangled up in some of the language that was directly targeting the northern tier seasonal rec community. So we've come up with a new some language that we're putting before you today that would extend the Class 4C commercial seasonal rec residential property tax classification to Lanesboro. So without further explanation, I think I'll introduce Julie Keeney, who's the Chamber Executive Director.
And yes. Senator Erickson-Ropes, what I'm understanding is this would be an effort to expand this property tax class rate to what might be thought of as kind of bed and breakfast type facilities. Am I clear in that?
Mr. Chair, the bed and breakfast we've already taken care of. This would be for small inns.
Small inns.
Yeah, so we have two innkeepers with us today. The bed and breakfasts have been brought into the fold, but we still have small inns that are not the large franchised ones, just very small inns that still fall outside the seasonal rec definition, and it's killing them.
Okay. Ms. Keeney. Ms. Keeney.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Chairman and Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today and be on your agenda. whereas we look at the law and believe that the intent is for one size to fit all, in our case, we are finding that there are unintended consequences that are having a negative effect on our tourism businesses in all, in our community. We represent the Lanesboro area. We are a small town, population 788, and our tourist-based economy is comprised of privately owned businesses that are on a seasonal tourist season. The commercial tax rates on our seasonal businesses are not feasible for business in our area. The current law limits our business. Innkeepers are adjusting their practices to fit into this classification, and they are forced to turn away business. Specifically, in the current law, requiring at least 60% of all paid bookings by lodging guests during the year must be for periods of at least two consecutive nights. Fillmore County generates $4.7 million of gross sales in lodging annually. Our goal is to work with you. We want to stimulate the local business, support our small business owners, generate more sales tax for the state, and accommodate our tourists that are wishing to stay for one night stay only. We are asking for equity across the state, whereas we believe this bill is not covering all of the different pockets of our region. So thank you.
Ms. Keene, are these businesses, they're open year-round?
Yes, they are in the seasonal status. However, the window of opportunity really for our seasonal tourist base is, just before Memorial Day and then up through the fall. We do extend beyond the typical Memorial to Labor Day. We have the shoulder seasons where we have tourist activity as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Buck. Point is they are open more than 250 days a year.
Those that qualify under this are adhering. They are changing their business practices to only be open 250 days of the year. So if they have someone walk through their door, they're having to turn away business in order to fit into this classification.
Ms. Lehman, I apologize for the...
Hi, my name is Colleen Lehman, and I have an inn in Lanesboro. Been in business for 8 years, and when I first opened my doors, I could not understand the reason why all of my other innkeeping friends required this two-night minimum. And come to find out, there was a reason behind this, and it was the tax burden part of it. inns in our area have already made the shift. They've been doing this for 3 to 4 years, actually. So when you ask the question, are these properties open year-round? They could be considered year-round properties, but in order to fit this tax classification, they have chosen to be open, closed, I should say, 115 days out of the year. Because the benefit of the classification outweighs having one guest here, one guest there. I have been working with, we have now in Lanesboro a seasonal recreational committee, and I have been working with Ron Vickery, our county assessor. I had a conversation with Ron just a few weeks ago, and I told him that we were coming to Hospitality and Tourism Day at the Capitol, and I told him that we would hopefully be getting a hearing on this. And he said, when I told him what we were proposing, he said, "My, wouldn't that make life easier for all of us?" Because along with the law and the counting of all of the days, it also is done by room and rate. And we do understand that if you are going to be classified as seasonal, you do need to fall within a certain number of days. That is not the point that we are saying we're not falling with. We're just asking for a little bit better verbiage to accommodate those people who don't own, don't have snowmobile rentals, fish houses, bait shops, and all of those things that Northern Minnesota provides.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Stang?
Susang?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for having me here today. I'm Lynn Susag. I'm the manager of the Cottage House Inn in Lanesboro. And what we'd really like you to consider is just extending this property classification. It would really help enable those of us who have privately owned inns to be able to better serve those folks who are traveling in the state of Minnesota. We know that people like to get away, and sometimes they just want to get away for one day when it's a beautiful sunny day, and we don't want to be thinking in the month of May on a Wednesday, well, gee, should we let them in our doors today or not, because we have to fit into these categories. So that is basically what it gets down to. We want you to take that into consideration, and thank you for thinking about that.
Thank you for traveling today. I apologize for the short time. I think the best thing for us to do, Senator Erickson-Ropes, is to just, we will pick this up. It'll be the first item on our agenda when we meet next time, either next Wednesday or the following Wednesday. And really, in the intervening couple weeks, will give me an opportunity to get a little more up to speed on what's going on here, too. So we'll continue this discussion. My apologies.
Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Can I just say these people represent a wonderful city in southern Minnesota, and they're obviously wonderful people. I would most wonderfully like to spend one night in Lanesboro this summer now that I'm retired, and it's a fabulous town, and I hope we can help them.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, we'd love to have you come down for one day and be able to stay overnight and be able to have our inns open their doors to you.
Thank you. Even though we're not done, we do need to adjourn the meeting, and so this committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.